All right, so last week we started in on chapter 46, and we took a massive stretch through the first four verses and took a little bit of a look at the sacrifice and affirmation, so the sacrifices that Jacob had made prior to leaving the land and the affirmation that he received back from the Lord in terms of this being a journey that he should take and feeling the confidence with that. Now, hopefully, Lord willing, what we will do this week is finish chapter 46 through the first part of 47. Next week, we will finish chapter 47, and we'll do a little pause at the end of that to talk about where we might go next. Now, what I'll share with you are my thoughts, and it's not quite a democracy, but I would like to hear your feedback on that. Maybe we'll take a congregational vote here, since we have a congregational leadership, not. But we'll take a look at kind of what we might do next when we finish finish the book of Genesis. And then Matthew is going to share with us some teaching on sanctification, which I'm personally looking forward to. I think it's really a great topic. As we think about the fact that we are pressed to go on to maturity in our faith. We all think about saving faith and how wonderful that is, but oftentimes we forget the charge we have after saving faith to continue to press on to maturity. And I'm sure that he'll do a wonderful job with that. And then we'll finish up sometime in August, and gosh, maybe by the fall we'll be into another book, which is kind of amazing. So thankfully, it's so easy to teach when you're just going to teach the Bible, because all you have to do is figure out what you're going to do next. You don't have to go home and dream something.
Real easy to teach.
Yeah, real easy to teach. It is funny. I mean, on the one hand, I have to say, you know, it's hard work to do expository teaching, and, you know, it's joyful work. But I can't imagine what these guys do that just preach topically week after week. I mean, I'd just be dumbfounded, and it'd be Friday morning before I'd figure out what I was thinking I might do, and then I'd be scrambling for Sunday. And I just love the fact that, what are you going to teach next? Well, right where we left off last week, we'll pick up from there. So with that in mind, that's what we'll do. Last week we looked first at the sacrifice and affirmation in verses 1 to 4. This week we're going to start in with the recording of the families in verses 5 to 27. The emotional reunion in 28 to 30, again, like we typically see in the book of Genesis, we have these long buildups, and then, boom, we have a little climactic event, a few verses, and then we kind of move on to the next scenario. Joseph's resettlement wisdom in terms of how he prepares the family to meet Pharaoh and get their wishes accomplished, and then finally the resettlement itself in the first 12 verses of chapter 47. Now, Danae, you're going to have to wait to read today, because I'm not going to make you read all these names. So I will read verses 5 to 27, and you'll get your chance to read after that, okay? All right, so let's read verses 5 to 27 to get us started here. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, where he had been worshiping, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the wagons, which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now, these are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt: Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, the sons of Reuben, Hanoch, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi, the sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin and Ohad and Jachin and Zohar and Shaul, and the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, names we're familiar with and we'll hear again. The sons of Judah, and Onan and Shelah and Perez and Zerah, but and Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. The sons of Issachar, Tola, and Puva, and Job, which would be probably like Job, and Shimron, the sons of Zebulun, Sered, and Elon, and Jalil. These are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Padan Aram, and with his daughter Dinah. All his sons and his daughters numbered 33. The sons of Gad, Ziphion, and Haggai, Shuni, and Esbon, Eri, and Aradi, and Areli, the sons of Asher, Imnah, and Ishva, and Ishvi, and Beriah, and their sister Sarah, the sons of Beriah, Heber, and Malchiel. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Leah, and she bore to Jacob these 16 persons. The sons of Jacob's wife Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. Now to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore to him. The sons of Benjamin, Bela and Becher and Ashbel and Gera and Naaman, Ahi and Rosh, Mupim and Hupim. Interesting, Mupim and Hupim. Kind of like Whoopim and Bupim. And Ard. These are the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob. There were 14 persons in all. The sons of Dan, Hushim, the sons of Naphtali, Jaziel and Guni and Jazer and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah who Laban gave to his daughter Rachel. And she bore these to Jacob. There were 7 persons in all. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. Okay, so we got through the hard part, which is reading the genealogy, always is. So we have the record of the families proceeds here in 2 parts. In part 1, which is in verses 5 to 7, we kind of have a summary statement of the traveling party. And then in verses 8 to 27, we have what I've just labeled a selective shipping manifest. So particular names are labeled in the genealogy that they want to record with regard to who came down to Egypt. Now, having God's approval, Jacob sets out for Egypt. So what do you think is the main point of verses 5 to 7? What's the main point of verses 5 to 7? I'll look for deep, dark secrets.
That everybody was on board.
You got it, okay? Everybody in the kitchen sink went down, okay? So everybody went along with them down there. Jacob took the sons of Israel, so his 11 boys. He took the sons' wives and their little ones. He took their livestock and their flocks and their property. Now, what would the property include?
Animals,
livestock, yeah, what else?
Slaves.
Slaves, okay. So it would have included everything, all the kitchen sink items that Pharaoh said don't bring. Remember when Pharaoh said bring them on down? Just bring the big stuff. We got all the furnishings down here. But they packed everything up that they took down. And in addition to that, slaves would have been considered their property. So slaves that they had acquired in the land. Now remember, this is not slavery as we understood it as it happened in America. This was kind of an indentured servanthood, and slaves were treated quite well because they were the responsibility of the owner to feed and take care of. So everything in the kitchen sink and any slaves that they had acquired. Now, Jacob must have been a Depression era kind of guy. So either he was raised in China, where you ate every last little kernel of rice, and if you don't do that, you don't get your next meal, or he wanted to make sure he had everything with him. Now, we have to figure out what is happening in 8 to 27 and address an apparent numerical problem, okay? So first off, what's the numerical problem that we encountered in these verses? There's a numerical problem in the verses. It's right at the end. Look at verses 26 to 27 again.
67.
Right. So, gosh, in the course of one verse, you can't remember whether it was 66 or 70. So in one verse he says 66 came down, the other verse he says 70. Okay, so we'll have to kind of address that. Verse 26, 66, verse 27 is 70. It's further complicated, because I know your New Testaments well, because Stephen cites this in his speech in Acts 7, and he refers to 75, and what he is citing or quoting from is the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So we basically have 66, 70, and 75 as the 3 different numbers of people that went down to Egypt. Now, this is the kind of thing that people love to pick on if they don't trust the veracity of the Bible. Okay, they like to pick on these meaty topics Like, well, how can that be right? Because obviously there's contradictions in the Bible. Now, before we get to resolving it, which is pretty easily resolved, I will spare you the LXX one because we'll spend enough time just getting the 66 and 70 taken care of. But the fact of the matter is, it is easy to resolve, but we do. Let me overview for you verses 18 to 20, 8 to 27. First, we have to consider the purpose of this selective genealogy. And I think it's actually has twofold, one a bit more primary than the other, but there's kind of a twofold purpose. One is to draw attention to the fact that there's been modest growth for the almost 200 years that they've been in the land, right? So remember the Abrahamic covenant provisions, right? I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and always this constant rejoinder. You're going to have a multitude greater than the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea. And yet at this point in time, we see that the family is just a little modest clan. Okay, 70-some people. Now, probably a bit more than that because wives are not counted. Some of the female children are not counted and so forth. But at best, there's maybe a couple hundred people over these 200 years. So they haven't really seen that explosion. So first noting that a very small portion goes down to Egypt. And then by contrast, some 400 years later, Numbers tells us, as well as Numbers tells us, that there were 600,000 men that left Egypt. All right, so if you just do kind of a family household of four, that says we're somewhere in excess of 2 million or so people that the nation had grown to over the next 400 years. So we see this fulfillment of God's promise to build them into a great nation. But secondly, and I think kind of more important to the particular context here, is this idea of identifying the fathers of the leading clans or the families that are going to be prominent in Israel's early history. So you'll see some of these names. Some are very identifiable, right? The sons of Levi, Merari, Gershon, and I can't remember the third one, you probably can. But they were going to be active in serving the temple and so forth. So we see kind of the prominent families in Israel's history. And if you're kind of want to trace these things, you'll see these names reappearing as we continue through the Pentateuch and the process. So we consider next the arrangement of the genealogy. So what's the arrangement? How is it organized? What's the organizing principle here?
By each tribe or each son.
It is a little bit, but there's a higher level synthetic that it's organized by. Yeah, okay, by each mother. Okay. So they organize them by wife group. Now I say wife group because what's the pattern? You have Leah first, right? The actual wife, then what? Her servant or her handmaiden, who she gives to Zilpah, I guess, who she gives to Jacob, right? So first is Leah and her maid, Zilpah, and their progeny. Okay, so the men that came out of that. Followed by Rachel and her maid Bilhah and their progeny. Okay? Now, within all this, there's only one line of descendants, if you were reading closely or listening closely, that kind of stretches credulity. Okay? You know which one it is? There's kind of one line of descendants that kind of stretches believability about really could there be that member. What? Which one?
Joseph?
No. No, not Joseph. Yeah, they had 33 children, that's right. But within the children themselves, which one kind of stretches credibility just a bit? Huh? No, okay. Starts with a B.
Benjamin
stretches credulity a bit, okay. And why? Do you know why it kind of stretches our minds a bit? Yeah, okay, David got it. He's young, okay? So it records him as having 10 sons. And at this point in time, he's somewhere in between 23 and 25 years old. Yeah. Now, given that they probably started a little earlier, that's still kind of stretching credulity in terms of the process of these 10 sons. Again, something that people that want to kind of impugn the Bible's truthfulness try to pick on. So what is the potential solution to that? How might we solve that problem? Roger?
Multiple wives.
Well, it could have been multiple wives, yeah, but I don't think we have any record of that we could push on at this point.
Twins,
okay, that's a creative thought, yeah. Okay, that would be triplets, or maybe the, what is that, that show with eight kids or something, or, what's that?
Born in Egypt, and this was written retrospectively.
Yeah, okay, I think you're getting to the ultimate solution here. Okay, so therefore, what would that mean is being recorded. So David said, born in Egypt, written retrospectively. Okay, so it has been written by Moses. That's correct, which would imply what about the 10 names listed?
Not all of them traveled into Egypt.
Yeah, but it says they did.
I know, well.
Yeah. Well, we got to hold on. We got to hold on the fact the Bible's true.
Benjamin's loins.
Yeah, okay. You're getting closer to it. So Benjamin's loins, so that's good. We're recording probably children and grandchildren. Okay, so if it's written retrospectively, right, a later genealogy, Moses, he has access to more genealogical data and time. And then David solved the other problem, which is in what sense did they go down if they didn't actually go down? Okay, and there's this idea, so let me kind of walk you through that. Sons and grandsons are listed. It raises another problem. The other problem is, how can they be recorded if they're not yet born, and how can they be said to be a part of the traveling party? All of which leads us back to the beginning and the purpose of the list, which is to identify the fathers of the leading clans. Okay? Yes?
In the Bible, doesn't God refer sons to, like, sons and grandsons?
Yeah. So sons can be used interchangeably with the word grandsons. Exactly. So it is sons and grandsons, okay? But yet, how can we have this if they haven't been born? How do we know the names? Well, two parts of that. One is the fact that Moses is the author, and he's writing retrospectively or after the fact, so he has access to additional genealogical data, so we don't have to get all fussy about that one. It's there, okay, there's a logical reason. And secondly, ancient Near East custom counts those who are in the loins of their father as if they already existed. Okay, so turn to Hebrews, all right, we see this, Hebrews chapter 7, verses 9 and 10. Okay, somebody read that for me when we get there. Danae, you want to read that? Hebrews 7, 9 and 10.
Sure.
Hebrews chapter 7, verses 9 and 10.
And so to speak to Abraham, even Levi, who see tithes, for he was still the loins of his father when met him.
Okay, so when Melchizedek met him, right? So we remember this event, right, back in when he had come back, and he'd paid tithes to Melchizedek, right? He'd been brought the spoils back, paid tithes to Melchizedek earlier in the book of Genesis. And we see here this concept of being in the loins of. Now, this also is important relative to kind of the whole theology around sin and how sin is, in fact, passed down to us. So Christ as our federal head, and there are different views of how that happens in the process. So you see this concept of they're in the loins of the Father. Okay, so again, there's nothing incorrect about what we're seeing in here. We're just seeing this book written in a way and to a culture that understands genealogies much differently than we do and pays attention to genealogies much differently than we do. Now, also in Numbers 26, 38, and 40, written by Moses, we have credence to this, okay? So if you turn to that just real quickly, Numbers 26, and I'll read that. Numbers 26, 38 to 40, again, as they're doing these broader genealogies that are recorded in the book of Numbers, we have this, the sons of Benjamin according to their families, of Bela, the family of the Belites, of Ashbel, the family of the Ashbelites, of Ahiram, the family of the Ahiramites, of Shephufam. That's an interesting one. Shephufam. Okay. Sounds like a Chinese food. Of Shephufam. I'm going to have to ask Katie what that is. Of Shephufam, the family of the Shufamites, of Hufam, the family of the Hufamites, the sons of Bela. Okay, so here we're seeing the next generation, sons of Bela, Ard, Naaman, Ard, we have recorded back in the Genesis record. Okay, So we see this concept of sons and grandsons, and this is kind of the fuller genealogy. So it doesn't stretch truthfulness. It stretches truthfulness as we sometimes understand it in the West. So what we have here is this selective list of heads of families who are prominent in Israel's early history. And these are clans or heads of families. There may have been others. There may have been other things that maybe they weren't big enough to actually be clans or heads of families. Now, with regard to the 66 versus the 70, the solution is actually pretty simple. I'll just run you through it. So we're told that in verse 15 that Leah had 33 children. Okay, 33 are credited to her, and her maid Zilpah had 16. So that gives us 49. Moving on to Rachel and Bilhah, they had another 21. That's recorded for us. And we add one for Dinah, who is listed. We add all that together, and we get what? 71, right? So 49, 21, 70, plus 1, 71. From that, we subtract Joseph and his two sons. Okay, so that's 3. And Onan, who had died in the land. We're specifically told that. See the parentheses as we're going through that? Mm-hmm. So we take 71 minus 5. What do we have? 66. Who went down to Egypt. Okay, all holds together. Add back then those who are in Egypt, okay, Joseph and his two sons, and Jacob, who has not yet been accounted for, and what do we have? 70, okay? So the numbers do work out. This number is affirmed in Exodus, okay? Just as we get done with this and we move into the account in Exodus, chapter 1, 1 to 5, it tells us about 70 had come down to Egypt, okay? So we don't have to be concerned. These numbers do work out. And there are really a couple of things I kind of want to focus on. Well, before I do that. Now, Stephen's use of 75 can also be logically explained in a couple different ways. But I think we're worn out on numbers right now. So we're going to go to the trust me category. Okay, hopefully after 2 years of going through Genesis, you'll give me a little trust at this point in time. But it has to do with, you know, if you're counting wives or this or different things like that. But again, it all works itself out in terms of the numbers. We don't have to be concerned about the veracity of the Bible. So takeaways, there's no problems with the Bible's veracity. There's a lot that we as Westerners don't understand or relate to with regard to genealogies, right? I mean, only recently, what's this, 23andMe, those ads where we've got this new interest in America for finding out what our genealogy is. Some guy thinks he's got his kilt on and know I'm this, and okay, big deal. And we have Ancestry.com. I think it's great. It's kind of interesting to trace that if you're interested in those kinds of things. But genealogies were much more important in their culture, and they paid a lot of attention to it. And we see a lot of them in Genesis. We're going to see more of them in Numbers. And it's all ultimately, as contrasted to how people want to pick on them, it's to prove the truthfulness of the story of the Bible. So they lay down this detail so we can track it back. And there are scholars that track this stuff, and it is remarkably reliable in terms of what we can know. Now, there's one commentator that I like, Leupold, and he summarizes the purpose of all of this with this statement, and I think it really kind of sums it up well. He says that shortly after the children of Israel had come to Egypt, there were to be found those 70 fathers from whom were derived the 70 clans that were the prevailing clans throughout Israel's early history. So this is why he pauses to give what I call this kind of specific manifest of who came down. He's setting the stage for things that will be used later in the Bible and later in the account in the Pentateuch with regard to who the key families were in Israel's early history as it developed in the land of Egypt. Okay? Any questions, concerns, thoughts on that? Anybody? Yes, sir.
I'm just thinking of the book of Matthew. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, Jesus always goes back to the Old Testament, and the importance of the genealogy is how the Jews knew the history because of how important this was.
Yeah.
Okay. And how Jesus referenced, you know, in the book of Matthew especially, back in the Old Testament, the book of Deuteronomy. And,
Yeah, but, well, let's just take the beginning of Matthew, right?
Yeah.
The genealogy.
Right.
And you can find all kinds of problems with that in terms of skipping some generations, three groups of 14, and kind of what they're going through. But the whole point of it was to point out that Christ was the promised Messiah, and he did descend exactly how the Old Testament had predicted it. So, yeah, Matthew is a particularly fun study of the New Testament's use of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And he looks back to the Old Testament frequently, more than any of the other Gospels, to prove, you know, the point that he's making about, look, this is the Messiah. Spoke about him here, spoke about him here, spoke about him here.
Yeah.
And you go back and you see how they do that. So it's an interesting study. I took one course on that my final year, and it's tricky to see how the New Testament writers use the Old Testament at times. You know, you kind of wonder, what are they doing? But, you know, if you dig into it, it's always logical. I will tell you, it probably stretched my brain more than anything else that I took from a seminary perspective, because you do have to think. And the other thing we have to understand is they knew their Bibles way better than we know our Bibles. And so they could connect these themes logically as they moved through the Old Testament into fulfillment in the New Testament. And it is. It's a rather fascinating study to spend some time on. Okay, any other thoughts on that before we move on? Yeah, Jack.
They must have really kept accurate records.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they use those records to exclude people,
mm-hmm.
like rebuilding the temple and Eli and all that?
Yep.
The wall.
Yep.
And they opened up these books that nobody had looked at in like a million years. And
yeah.
It was.
Exactly right. So the point of the fact is that, you know, I love the archaeology studies, and Ken, who's not here this week, loves Biblical Archaeological Review. It's a good little, a magazine or periodical that talks about different discoveries they make in the ancient Near East, or in the Middle East right now. And one guy kind of phrased it this way. He said, the more they dig things up, the more they prove the Bible is correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact of the matter is, there's nothing they've dug up that denies, in fact, it just proves more and more the veracity of what we're told in the process. So we have a lot to hang our hat on and to be confident about as we go through that. All right, somebody read verses 28 to 30 for me, please.
Now I sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept unto him a long time. Then Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive.
Okay, so we have this very emotional reunion, right? So they've arrived at the outskirts of Egypt, and Jacob sends Judah ahead to announce their arrival and to get some directions. Now, why does he do that? Why does he kind of send an advance party out? Okay, it's kind of like a harbor pilot, right? You ever seen a big ship come into a harbor? There's a harbor pilot that actually has to guide them right to the final place as they're going through there. So Goshen was a big place. Let's see if this works this week or not. Nah, it doesn't seem to want to. Let's go down to the bottom here. So Goshen's kind of a big place, right? So remember, you started up there in Hebron, the blue circle in your top right, down to Beersheba, where they sacrificed and affirmed things. Then they kept coming down on this travel road, and Goshen itself is the whole big Nile Delta. Okay, it's a big, big geographical area. So they've kind of arrived on the eastern border of what is known as Goshen, and they're pausing for instructions on, okay, which neighborhood do you want me to go into, if you will, in terms of what's happening there. Right, so it's a big place, and Jacob wanted to know where they were going to pitch their tent, okay? So Joseph immediately departs in his royal regalia, right? Hops into his chariot, his own chariot. I guess that was kind of the Lamborghini of the day, whatever it is, whatever your favorite fancy car is. And he commences the tearful reunion with his father. Now, verse 30 is kind of a figure of a speech, something, you know, we would say often too. He's basically saying, now that I've seen you, my life is complete. I can go at any time. But in fact, we know in actuality, he's going to live another 17 years in the land. We'll learn that as we get a little further on. But I think there's kind of a good model in that for us, maybe kind of an implication for us. As you think about how your life is different when you come to know the Lord in saving faith, I mean, we really can say something quite similar, right? Hey, look, I don't need to live another day. You can take me home and be with the Lord. Now, probably, you know, a harsh talk for some at times, and you know, I'm thankful to be here and have an opportunity to minister and do things, and I haven't quite got my head wrapped completely around, you can take me tomorrow, Lord, but if that's his will, that'll happen. I know that Katie used to always tell me that, oh yeah, I just wish I could go die and go home to the Lord. I'm like, what'd you marry me for then? Leave me alone. But, you know, it is
a commentary on you.
Well, yeah, it is a commentary on me. I've already admitted many times she's more spiritual than I am. But the fact of the matter is, it is a good lesson for us, right? I mean, as we think about it, as we think about our lives as Christians, okay, now that we know you, Lord, really, we can go at any time. Right? So turn to the New Testament. We have kind of a great example of this with Simeon and Anna. Remember those two in Luke's Gospel, chapter 2?
Oh, yeah.
Luke's Gospel, chapter 2, and verses 25 to 28. Right? They had both said, Lord, just let me live, basically, what? To see the Messiah. Right? So then starting in 21, and when the 8 days had passed before his circumcision, his name was then called Jesus, the name given by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. And when the days of their purification according to the law of Moses were completed, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male that opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to what was said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves and two. Now, and there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was what? Simeon. And this man was righteous and devout, looking for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. And when it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ, and he came in the Spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus to carry out for him the custom of the law, then he took him into his arms and blessed God and said, Now, Lord, you are releasing your bondservant to depart in peace according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation. And it goes on to talk about Anna. Okay, so truly, as we are saved and as we are genuinely in faith, we really shouldn't fear anything else. And there should be just a genuine desire to go home and be with the Lord, again, under his control and under his timing. So, verses 31 to 34, someone read those for me, please.
Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh, and will say to him, My brothers and my father's household, who were in the land of Canaan, come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds, and all that they had. When Pharaoh calls you and says, What is your occupation? You shall say, Your servants have been keepers of livestock, from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, in order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians.
Okay, so now in this section we're going to see what I've labeled the resettlement wisdom of Joseph. So what is going on in these verses? Kind of, what's the general point of these verses here?
Keeping the family separate mm-hmm. from the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the outcome. Kind of, but what's the point of what Joseph is doing here in preparation for that? Yeah.
He's been the overseer of Egypt. He knows where the good grazing land is.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to make sure that they get it.
Yeah, okay, I think that's true, but what would be in Joseph's mind? Joseph's a thoughtful guy, he's a good administrator. What do you think would be thinking, Jack?
Is he reminding Pharaoh of the decree that occurs with him?
Yeah, we're going to get to that. That's part of it. You guys kind of get them all around the thing. The idea here is, having arrived, Joseph needed to present the family to Pharaoh. Okay? I mean, you know, they're here. Pharaoh said, go fetch them. Okay? And now they're there. And to secure Pharaoh's approval for them to settle in Goshen. Okay? So even though Joseph, he's positioning Pharaoh and his brothers for the answer he wants, reminding us that he's got a little bit of Rebecca in him. Okay? But why does he take this approach? Okay, even though it's a bit staged, it is a wise one. Why does he take this approach?
Their stories are the same.
What's that?
So their stories are the same.
Yeah, okay, that's one. So they present a story that is the same story, and with those brothers, that's probably pretty good thinking. Okay, they can get off the mark pretty easily. What else though? Yeah.
His brothers are not Egyptians, so he's bringing in people that don't belong there with their culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Those are all things. So you're getting into his reasoning. Here's where I think he's going. He probably had the unilateral authority to settle them wherever he wants. Okay. Because he was the number two in the land, whatever he said. But he was wise to seek Pharaoh's blessing on the parcel that he had identified as the best of the land. So he's seeking Pharaoh's blessing for where he wants to settle them. Now, why would that be important? Why would that be important? Just think, no deep things here, just common sense though. Well, honor to Pharaoh, yeah, sure. Yeah, Pharaoh does make the ultimate decision, okay?
Well, the culture is going to reject them because they're shepherds.
Okay.
Right. But if they have the Pharaoh's blessing, that
right.
kind of pressures the rest of the population to go with the flow.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay, so I think you guys have kind of gotten right to the key idea here. So that no one's going to second guess him at a later date. Okay, it was Pharaoh's decision to settle them in the land. Pharaoh's word is final. Even as much power as Joseph has, I think all these things you guys identified are right. They are still Jews. They're not Egyptians. They're going to get the best of the land. They're going to prosper. And we're going to learn some other things about what they get in this process that's better than the typical Egyptian. So I think it was very wise for him to have Pharaoh confirm it so that no one can accuse him of nepotism at the expense of the native Egyptians. Okay? You just holding your pen? Or you have an urgent thought there.
Obedience to God.
Right.
And I'm just thinking about the New Testament, how God, you know, Paul tells us to, you know, submit to the authorities,
mm-hmm.
to the higher
yeah.
people who God has given us.
Right. Well, you think of Christ alone, right? In the garden, what did he say? Not my will, but your will be done. I mean,
yeah.
submitting our will to the Lord's will, and certainly those types of things. But, you know, again, Joseph is a wise administrator. And he has been wise in everything he's done so far. He wanted Pharaoh to basically say, yep, this is where we want you to go. Which gives us some good implications, right? First of which is, to the extent it's possible, it's a good thing to think things ahead in terms of what might come later. And to the extent that we can be at peace with all men, so far as it depends on us, we should do so. So Joseph, again, is taking a step he probably doesn't have to take, but he's doing so to ensure that he's got Pharaoh on board, anticipating what things may happen. And then now you notice how Joseph plans to present the family. So what are the three key elements of his introduction of the family? What are the three key things about the family that he wants to convey? What are they?
Shepherds.
Shepherds, okay. So they're shepherds, right? What have they been doing all their lives? Okay, keeping sheep, right? Keeping livestock, right? And what have they done? They brought those stinky animals with them. Okay? So basically he said, look, this is what you need to tell them. Tell them you're shepherds. We've been shepherds all our lives, basically saying, hey, we can't do anything else. That's all we know how to do. And oh, by the way, they brought all their livestock with them. Okay? So Joseph is positioning, and then he concludes with two reasons for this approach. Okay, so what are his reasons for kind of highlighting these three points? What are his reasons for that? Pharaoh's going to ask some questions, absolutely. And he wants Pharaoh to ask the questions he wants him to ask, right? So that there can only be one logical conclusion, which is what? Settle here. Okay? So, to secure the settlement in Goshen, because shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians, okay? So again, he's just using their culture and what he probably anticipates that Pharaoh's going to ask them, because he knows Pharaoh very well, to get Pharaoh to give them the permission that they want. So Goshen is the perfect place for both parties because it'll keep the two cultures isolated from one another. Yeah?
Why were they an abomination to the Egyptians?
Shepherds were kind of looked down on as dirty, you know, classless. You know, I mean, I don't know, why do we label certain people abominations in any society, right? You know, they're beneath us, they're below us, they're stinky, they're dirty, they're hanging out with those sheep. Jack?
Well, I mean, unless the Egyptians were all a bunch of vegetarians, they must have gotten meat from somewhere.
They did, and they did have some that tended livestock, but we'll see again as we get to the end of this, right? It wasn't something that the hoity-toity would want to do, right? So there were some, they do, absolutely right. David, did you have a comment?
I had a note in my Bible where it suggests that the resentment could come from the Hiskos.
Yeah, that gets... we'll get to that in just a second. Okay, so he's talking about the actual... This gets to who was ruling at the time that this happened. This gets into some issues on the dating of the Exodus and when they actually came down. We're going to cover that in just a second. The Hyksos were of partially Jewish descent or ancient Near Eastern descent, and they did come in and conquer and rule in Egypt for a period of time. That is a possible reason. I think the timing's off on that, though. So it's going to keep the two cultures apart. Oh, yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I was just thinking, was there a lack of cattle in Egypt? And would Joseph say this? Okay, this, you know, maybe because Pharaoh, we're lacking these things.
Yeah, no, because there were some.
I'm just wondering.
Because had cattle in it.
Yeah.
His dream had seven cattle.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and they're going to have that, and they and they've been preserving some of that, and they're going to actually say, "Hey, tend our flocks since you're good at flocks."
Okay.
So there's some of that, but no. It's just it's like any society. Look at America.
Yeah.
I mean, every new ethnic culture that comes into America, everyone is trying to get somebody else to be at the bottom end of the food chain. You know, someone comes in, some culture works hard, boom, another culture drops down, another ethnic group. It's just the hard-heartedness of man. I mean, I think. Earl, it's the kind of basic reason. I mean, they're prejudiced towards the Hebrews, okay? Hebrews are hairy, right? The Egyptians were all clean-shaven and neat and clean and just a different sense of society and how they were. So Goshen also had fertile grazing land suitable for large herds, and it is contiguous to Canaan. So remember, Goshen's the first area that you begin to, that you hit as you're moving into the land of Egypt, notwithstanding that Egypt may have, you know, been a vassal over them, or Canaan might have been a vassal state at this point in time. So why is that important? Why is it important that they kind of settled on the eastern edge of the Egyptian territory? Roger?
The land was probably very similar in topography and grazing areas.
Yeah, could be. But
as well as it's a quick way back.
Ah, there's a good reason, because it's going to make an easy departure someday, right? So they're settled on the eastern border. We know, because we know the rest of the story, they're going to take them back out of Egypt at some point in time. So they're not way down into the cities, embedded inside the culture. They're kind of off in this little stockade, if you will, on the eastern border of the Egyptian nation, and it's going to poise them for an easy departure when that happens someday. So reunion and meeting preparation complete, Joseph returns to inform Pharaoh of his family's arrival. So somebody read the first 12 verses of 47 for me, please.
Then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen. And he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, 'What is your occupation?' So they said to Pharaoh, 'Your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers.' And they said to Pharaoh, 'We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen.' Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable man among them, then put them in charge of my livestock. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had ordered. And Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food, according to their little ones.
Okay. So, we're now going to get to the actual resettlement proper, right? So, the family's official resettlement, and it proceeds in four stages. First stage, 1-4, Jacob presents five selected family representatives to Pharaoh and their request, followed in by Pharaoh's approval to settle in Goshen in verses 5 and 6. Then in verses 7-10, Joseph presents his father to Pharaoh. And then finally in verses 11 and 12, the family settles in Goshen. Now, the introduction process begins with Jacob, or Joseph, and the five family representatives. And Joseph announces their arrival, their profession, possessions, and location, just as he said. Now, I wouldn't say that Joseph is pushing Pharaoh's buttons per se, but I would say that he knew how to elicit the questions that he wanted Pharaoh to ask. Okay, so he has guided the discussion with that, along with having a pretty good idea what Pharaoh's inquiries might be. Now, Joseph does his part. How do the brothers do on their part? Huh? Jack's giving me a no, okay, yeah?
Joseph told him, just tell him you're keeping some livestock, don't say the yes word.
You know, I know a police officer is going to get this one right every time, right? What's the basic rule when you're in front of the cops? Just answer the question. What's the rule of being in the court of law? Just answer the question, right? Don't get motor mouth in the process. So yeah, that's exactly what goes. I'd say they did mostly good, but they embellished, right? They started adding additional information, right? Now, what do they add? What do they add beyond what Joseph told them to say? Yeah, okay. So number one, they add an explanation for their arrival. Like, duh, I know there's a famine, okay, but they give them the explanation for the arrival. What else? They make an actual request to settle there in Goshen, okay? So an explanation for their arrival, a request to settle in Goshen, neither of which Joseph had instructed them to do. Okay, he wanted to lead Pharaoh to the natural conclusion of the process. Now, part of their addition, though, is helpful. Which part of what they add is helpful? What do they add right at the end there?
Capable of taking care of some of the livestock?
Well, that's true. That's capable of that, so they'll do that. It's kind of an interesting little factoid statement that they make.
Servants.
Yeah, servants, okay. Ah, very good. Very good observation. Emphasize that their occupancy plans are temporary as far as they knew. Okay? So again, I mean, it is another culture. It is taking the best of lands. As much as Pharaoh appreciates Joseph, he was probably relieved to hear that they viewed themselves as short-timers. Okay? So we're just sojourning down here in the land. So that was probably a good addition in the process. Now, what's Pharaoh's response?
Welcome.
Yeah, welcome. That's good. That's better. I use the vernacular. Okie dokie. Okay, okie dokie. Goshen is yours. Yeah, welcome. The land is yours. Exactly right. Okay? So, to Joseph, go ahead and settle them there. And now it's actually an imperative. Okay, so he's giving a command here. Go ahead and settle them there in the land. So Joseph has now gotten permission from the ultimate authority in the land to settle the family there anybody ever comes back at him, he can say, hey, wait a minute, it wasn't my call, it was Pharaoh's call. So I think he's thinking ahead and he's using his mind. So he offered them also jobs, right? Serving in areas the Egyptians didn't want to. So yes, they did have Egyptians that were serving as managers of livestock, but he said, hey, you guys have been handling livestock all these years, take over mine. And why would he say that? Well, it seems like everything that Joseph touches does pretty well, right? So man, maybe you can make my flocks grow too. Okay, so obviously he's doing that. And not yet done, now Joseph presents his father to Pharaoh. Now, what is it that Jacob does when he meets Pharaoh? It's kind of an interesting thing he does. What's that? Yeah, he blessed him, right? He blesses Pharaoh. So how does the lesser bless the greater? How do you work that out? In what way is he blessing Pharaoh? I mean, Pharaoh's the dude. He's the man. I got this kind of hairy shepherd guy in here, and he's blessing me. What's going on here?
Older, wiser.
That could be one thought, yeah. Okay, what else might be going on?
Don't we offer up blessings to God?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Thank you.
So, okay, so in what sense are we offering blessings to God? Are we bless God, really? That's the lesser blessing the greater.
Show our graciousness.
Yeah, okay, showing our gratefulness. Okay, so they're really kind of one of three possibilities. First of all, the word is used as a general sense of greeting and salutation. It's kind of like shalom, peace be with you, things of that nature. So that's one possibility. Second, when people bless God, and this is really what you said, it's praising the awesome goodness in him. Right, so the sense in which a lesser is grading, is blessing is superior, it's in recognition of his goodness and kindness and graciousness, and that's exactly the context of which we do. And I think this is the sense in which Jacob is praising Pharaoh for his goodness in the family. Now, thirdly, actually, in a very real sense, right, Jacob is superior to Pharaoh. The only problem is Pharaoh doesn't know that. Okay, so I mean, he is God's representative. He is in every way superior to Pharaoh. So he is blessing him perhaps in that context as well. So
I was just thinking, was he praising God because of where they left in Canaan, where mm-hmm. there was a famine?
Mm-hmm.
Now God brought them to Egypt, where mm-hmm. there's abundance of you know, things that would provide the need for Israel and his family.
Yeah, he's certainly thankful for that, but in the context of the blessing he's giving here, it's to Pharaoh. It's not for God's goodness in bringing him there. So he is blessing Pharaoh, and in this context, as a lesser, he's blessing him, probably for his goodness and his kindness. It could be just normal, polite discourse, but I also think there's this just underlying sense that in a very real way, right, he is in fact the superior because he is God's anointed in the process. So that's what's going on there. Pharaoh's only recorded question of Jacob is his age, right? Now, there's probably some more dialogue, but that's what they recorded, to which Jacob gives us his view of his life, which us old people tend to do, right? You generally have to ask an old person too long, so how's life? Well, let me tell you about that. My knee hurts, my shoulder hurts. And so what is his assessment? What is Jacob's assessment of his life? What's he say?
Few and evil.
Few and evil, okay? My life has been short. My days have been bitter. Okay, now, he's fair. It's right? Comparison to Abraham and Isaac. He lived a lot less in terms of years. He had to struggle for his God-given inheritance, right, against his brother. He had to flee from his brother's hostility. He had to endure Laban's endless trickery, right? And he suffered at the hands of his sons, first at Shechem with the Dinah incident, and then with the whole potential loss of Joseph, right? So indeed, he's giving an accurate answer, okay? But it is kind of interesting this. So all in all, Jacob's life has been more challenging than his forefathers, and there was likely more dialogue, but this is what Moses chose to record, bringing us really to the final stage of the settlement in verses 11 and 12. So having Pharaoh's sanction, Joseph officially settles the family in Goshen. And what is interesting about what's interesting in verse 11 about the settlement? What's it say?
Best of the land.
Best of the land.
Best of the land, yeah, that's one thing. But what does he call it? Jack?
He calls it a possession.
A possession, okay. So they're actually deeded, if you will, this land. And you'll learn a little later as we go on, the only other ones that'll be treated in the same way will be the priests, who will be exempted from taxation and all those kinds of things. So they were given possession of a choice piece of land. Okay? So again, Joseph thinks ahead to a time when his influence might wane. Right? So he thinks, hey, we got it good now. This Pharaoh likes us, but maybe we ought to kind of secure the deed to this land while things are going good. So, like Egyptian priests, as we'll see in the next chapter, the family is given a permanent foothold with no strings attached. Now, what else is interesting about the last two verses? Kind of what does it wrap up in its entirety, going all the way back to chapter 37? What do we have at the beginning of chapter 37?
Prophecy.
What's that?
The prophecies.
The prophecies, right? So what do we have now?
Fulfillment.
Fulfillment, okay? It completely fulfills Joseph's dreams. He has provided for his family, essentially ruling over his family, just as his dreams had prophesied. So reverting to Canadian, it's funny how things work out. Hey. Right? Okay, so it's interesting. God accomplishes his purposes. So one final note on the land of Ramesses, as Dave brought up a second here, and I'll kind of fly through this. The name does lead to some speculation with regard to the dating of the famine, okay, and subsequently the dating of the Exodus. Okay, so many assert that the name of the region must have arisen from the 19th Egyptian dynasty and the two pharaohs of that dynasty, which were Ramesses I and Ramesses II. Therefore, history records and attests this dynasty somewhere in 1370 to 1208 BC. As such, the area Israel settled in the cities of Exodus 1:11 derived their name from these pharaohs. Okay, so that's what the Lenny scholars say, which then in turn dates the Exodus to somewhere in circa 1290 to 1275 BC. Now, as we get to the book of Exodus, you're going to learn that there are two dates for the Exodus, right? There's what's known as the early date and the late date. And this always confuses me because we're doing negative numbers here, right? So the late date is this one. The early date would be 1444 BC or earlier in recorded history, okay? Because we're moving from negatives to positives, all right? Continuing, backing up 400 years, their time in Egypt places the famine about this time frame, marking something David brought up a minute ago, this as the Hyksos invasion in reign in Egypt as the pharaohs of Joseph's time. And since the Hyksos had Semitic roots, it explains their openness to the family of Jacob. Now, that is all very nice, and it is well put together, but is not supported by the biblical evidence, okay? And the biblical record supports somewhere around 1446 BC as the date of the Exodus, thus Joseph's time in Egypt aligning with the 12th dynasty quite a bit earlier than the Hyksos, okay? Which is all will be explained in more detail in the next study, but this is where scholars come up with these wonderful different things that they argue about. I think the Bible record will point us very clearly to the date of the Exodus, and that's that, which we'll disclose some more next week. So some closing thoughts as we wrap up today. From this point forward, we close with Jacob's patriarchy and Joseph's subsequent leadership of the family from that point and the book of Genesis. All this in three short chapters. Then as the Bible will do, it skips forward 400 years very quickly, moves to the book of Exodus, right? And picks up the story as we go on. So next week, we will take a look at the rest of chapter 47, which is Joseph's leadership and legacy. There's some final things that he does that are quite interesting. And then we're going to begin to see his legacy in terms of the blessings that he receives from his father, Jacob. And then we'll move on to the story. So it's kind of interesting. You know, it's really the second part of Genesis, which is chapters 12 to 20 to 50, is basically the three patriarchs, but often you'll see it outlined as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. But it's really all of Jacob as these two kind of parentheses, and then Joseph kind of sandwiched in the middle. So it's going to turn back to, in the final chapters, 48 through 50, to closing out Joseph's time, his final blessing, and then the transition of the nation after that period of time.